There are few things in life that interest me less than professional sports. Never been a big sports fan. I always played Little League. I was on the school, you know, football team and basketball team. Every year they let me play. And when I got into high school, I went out for the teams, but they always cut me. I can't imagine why. But I loved to play, but I just never could watch, you know, baseball, basketball, football, all that stuff, just and follow the on the newspaper. You know, the sports page in the paper to me was the least important page of the whole thing. I'd rather read the want ads. You know, I just not interested. And I know that sounds funny because I'm the one that has the Super Bowl party every year, but really that's just 'cause I want like to eat chili and hang out with my friends. Football game, you know, I could take it or leave it. But all of that to say, a few years ago, Mary and I got it in our heads that we wanted just once, you know, before the Lord takes us home, to see a real live NFL football game in person. And since Seattle's not that far away, we figured we'd go up there. We found this thing in the, I was probably reading the ads, not the sports section, and I found this ad where for, you know, like it was $99 a piece and you got a ticket. And you could go down and catch the Seahawk train at the train station in Portland. We lived in Tigard then. And so it seemed like a fun deal. You get up on a Sunday morning, you go down and ride the train up, you know, nice and leisurely, and it gets out right next door. Well, this is before they moved into the new stadium. They were still at Husky Field, so we get off the train and take a bus. And it was just an adventure, and we thought this will be fun to do. And I think I had just changed jobs from one church to another, so it was a good time to kind of do something different on a Sunday morning. And so we got on the Seahawk train. Now you might expect, is it not a reasonable expectation that the Seahawk train would be filled with Seahawk fans? I think that's reasonable, and that's what most of us were. Most of us. And Mary and I were sitting there in our seat, and it's only just like three or four cars long, and of course the bar car is at the back, and I didn't make it down there, and, you know, it's, who wants to go anyway at 7:30 in the morning, you know, or whatever it was, even if you wanted to go, who wants, well, there are those who want to go. But anyway, we're sitting there in our seat, and in the front of the, and we were going to see the Seattle Seahawks play the 49ers, San Francisco 49ers. So this is going to be a fun game. And we're on the train, and on walks this whole, you know, group of people, a couple of guys and a couple of gals and a couple of kids. It was a small little group. And they were decked out from head to toe in 49er gear. I mean, they had the hats and the coats and the pants and the shirts and the duffel bags and the beer can hider, you know, all that stuff that said 49ers on it everywhere. And I remember I looked at my wife and I said, these people are crazy. This is like, you know, Osama bin Laden getting on a bus full of Marines. It's like, what are they thinking? Well, apparently it was okay. And so they went right by us, probably back to the bar car. I don't know. So we got to the game, and we took the bus to the thing, and they took us to Husky Stadium. I'd never been there before. And we found our seats and sat down. Well, we didn't really sit down. I think impaled is probably a better word. We were impaled on these narrow little benches that kind of trapped you in, and then you couldn't get back out, you know, unless you did a lot of crunches, which I don't. And down from us, you know, a ways, are these three guys. Now, they had definitely been to the bar car. No question about it. Three guys, large men. Let's just leave it at that. And they had their Seahawk jerseys cut off right here. And then it was S-E-A, you know, H-A-W, Seahawks painted on the three of them. And every time the Seahawks would do something like catch a pass or, you know, make a first down or something, these guys would stand up and they would roll their bellies like they were doing the wave. And I looked at my wife and I said, those guys are crazy. They're out of their mind. I mean, there's like how many thousand people here, plus the things on national TV, and they're not trying to keep, I mean, they're hoping the camera gets them so they can do this kind of hula dance wearing their daughter's tube top, you know, basically. I said, people will do crazy stuff. You know, when they're into something, like a sports team or whatever it is, they'll do things they would never do. They'll wear things they would never wear. They'll say things they would never say. They get so caught up in the moment or, you know, in the momentum of the thing, whatever it is, the team or whatever, that they kind of suspend reality and the rules of normal life don't apply anymore. And, you know, the 49ers will walk on the Seahawk train and the guys will be out there doing the wave with their beer bellies. But, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It depends on what it is you're caught up in as to whether your behavior is appropriate or not. Let's read a couple of these verses in Mark chapter 3. I guess we need to get a running start. Let's remember what's gone on here. Jesus has come into Capernaum back in chapter 2 and went into the synagogue and taught, and they were all blown away. And then he went to Peter's house and he healed Peter's mother-in-law and several others. And he went out the next morning and prayed, and then they left the area for a while, and then they came back to Capernaum, and that's where he was teaching and healing, and had to get a boat, you know, off the shore so that the people wouldn't crush him. And then he went up on the mountain and called just the 12 to himself. You know, he named names and kind of figured out who his main guys were going to be. And we pick up the story here in the last part of verse 19, and they went into a house. We can assume here, I think, safely that they're back in Capernaum now, having come down from that mountain where Jesus chose the 12. They went into a house, and then the multitude, remember the big crowd, if you were last week, it wasn't just a lot of folks. You know, it was this mob mentality, kind of like, you know, when the rock star, when Michael Jackson walks through Safeway. That may not be the best example. Somebody really famous that we don't hate. Okay? Back Beatlemania, where we talked about how Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis just turned the world upside down, and Frank Sinatra and Elvis, and that kind of thing where they're clamoring after you, pulling at your hair and your clothes, and you're really not safe. So when it says the multitude came together, it doesn't mean a few hundred folks got together and sat politely. They were so enamored with him that they were kind of going after him. What they would do if they caught him, we can only guess. It says they came together again so that he couldn't so much as eat bread. He couldn't even stop and have lunch. The crowd was too big and too aggressive. But when his own people, now that's a reference to his family, his mom, his brothers and sisters, his stepfather Joseph has died by now. When his own people heard about this, they went out to lay hold of him, for they said, "He's out of his mind. That guy must be crazy." Jesus was so caught up in God, so caught up in God being the very center of his life, that his own family said, "He must be out of his mind." The language literally reads, "He must be beside himself." I mean, he's so out there that he's kind of not even him. He's somebody else beside himself. You know, they said the same thing about Paul. You won't need to turn there, but you might make a note. Acts 26, verse 24, the governor there said, Paul, after Paul had presented the gospel, he looked at Paul and said, "Your much learning has driven you mad. You know, you must be crazy to live the way you live and do the things you do and say the things you say and go the places you go. You must be out of your mind as well." Now, here's my question. Would anyone say that about you in regards to your faith and your life as a follower of Jesus Christ? Now, they may think of other reasons to say you're crazy, but would that make them say, "You must be out of your mind"? Do people think that you've lost your mind because your life is so centered around following Jesus? Because I'm here to tell you, they should. When you're doing it right, They will. See, these decisions that Jesus was making here, they were so radical. They were so far afield from, quote, normal behavior, that his own family came to take him by force if necessary. That's what it means in verse 21 when it says they went to lay hold of him. They were going to grab him. If he didn't go along with an invitation, they were going to physically drag him out of there. Now, why would they do that? What was he doing that was so strange and so radical that the people who loved him most, who cared for him the most, would go and say, you know what? If he doesn't want to come with us, we're just going to take him with us. That's pretty extreme. Why would they do that? Well, verse 20 tells us a little reason. They saw that he wasn't eating properly. And I suppose that's a factor. I mean, if someone's unable to eat, you want to, you know, and all that. But I don't really think that's the main issue here. They felt, no doubt, that he was taking his religious beliefs too seriously. I mean, come on. Come on, Yeshua. There's a place for that stuff. But let's don't take it too far. Let's don't go overboard and get carried away. See, from their perspective, Jesus was walking away from the most important things in life. But what he was really doing was trusting God for those things. And because of that, they thought he was crazy. When God is the center of your life, people might think you're crazy because you look to Him, you look to the Lord for security. Most people get their sense of security from their job or maybe their family. A job, that's easy. It provides financial security. We all need to know there's at least a trickle of cash flow coming in because the bills sure trickle in. And you just can't rest easy, or you don't rest easy if you don't have some idea that, you know, that the two are going to at least even up or come close. There's, you know, bills, everyday bills. There are expenses that come up now and again. You know, if you're smart or if you are able, you like to save a little. Maybe take a vacation now and then. Or if you're really a planner, you're setting aside a little nest egg for retirement so you don't have to worry about living hand to mouth, you know, in your later years. So there's some security there, financial security from a job. A job also provides security just from the position that you hold. Now, you may be the chairman of the board, or you may be the emptier of the trash. But at least you have a spot. And it's yours. And when you get up in the morning, you know where you're going and you know what you're going to do. You have a function, and there's great security just in that. You know, even if you don't like where you fit, at least you know that you fit. And there's a lot of security in that. Families, of course, give us all security. Even the most messed up. I mean, you may have the biggest bunch of lunatics and crazy nuts in your family tree, you know, but they're yours. And I grew up in a family where it was kind of weird. I never really understood it because, you know, it was always, I was too young to notice it and think about it till later, but there was something about my dad's side of the family where there were certain people didn't talk to other certain people. I don't know what went on. I don't want to know what went on. But the way they dealt with it wasn't to sit down and have a talk and work it out. They just, you know, cut people off. And I had an aunt and an uncle that were cut off from my dad, and another sister of his, another aunt. And then later on in the years, this aunt cut my mom off. It's so complicated, I don't even know. But that's the way they would do it. So years and years and years would go by, and there'd be no postcards, no Christmas cards, no letters, no phone calls, no keeping in touch, no guess who got married or guess which cousin had a baby. It was just as if that family tie never existed. But when something really big went down, you know, when Aunt Lyuna passed away, Funny how my mom knew right where to turn to find that phone number to call that aunt and that uncle that they hadn't spoken to for, gosh, 40 years. Family. Even in the worst case. Now, in the best case, I don't think we have to go on about that too much. I hope that most of us have some, you know, healthy, loving family. I know we're blessed with our kids and grandkids, and just couldn't be stronger. You know, there's a family bond, and there's a security in that. My son knows that no matter how, you know, I've got to be careful here. No matter how angry he makes me with his decisions to move to the other side of the country with my grandkids, Dad still loves him. Dad is still there when he needs anything. You know, you don't even have to ask twice. And I know that even though he's a couple thousand miles away with no family around him whatsoever, just knowing that Mary and I are here and that his in-laws are there, you know, and his sister is in Japan, but he knows that his family's there, and that just helps him sleep a little easier at night, knowing that he has family. So a lot of people, they get their security from their job or from their family. Now realize that Jesus gave all of that up. You know, he had a pretty good job. Then, a whole lot like now, being a carpenter wasn't a bad gig. There's always work to do. There's always something being built, something being fixed, something being put together, repaired. Always. And the pay wasn't bad. So, you know, steady work with a decent income. That's not something that you just sneeze at now or then. But Jesus effectively just walked away from that. And he also had a great family. Jesus was the oldest brother. You know, after Joseph died, Jesus kind of assumed the role as the man of the house. And we don't know exactly how old he was when that happened. But we know that by the time we get to the Gospels, he's in his late 20s, early 30s. And he's well established as the big brother and the man of the house and running the family carpenter business and making decisions and, writing up bids and accepting deals and shaking hands and making contracts, taking care of mom, taking care of the sisters, probably teaching the little brothers how to do the family business and giving them work to do and all that. He had a great spot, respected and loved and appreciated and important. But he walked away from what we would think of as a pretty solid situation. He effectively quit his job and he gave up his role in the family. Turned it over to the next brother, whoever that was. How could he be so crazy as to leave all that security? It's because he looked to God for his security. He didn't use money or family relationships to anchor him, you know, to make him feel safe in life. He used that relationship with the Father. He looked to the one who controls all the money and the one who is the father of all the families for his security. He made God the center of his life, and there is no greater security than that. And they said, he's out of his mind. When God's the center of your life, people might think you're crazy because you trust him for safety. Just plain old physical safety. Very few of us will ever be asked to put our lives at risk for our faith. Now, there are places in the world where a public confession of faith in Jesus Christ will get you killed. Iran comes to mind, Saudi Arabia, there are others, the Sudan. You don't carry your Bible. You don't wear that cross necklace or, you know, an I found it bumper sticker or Jesus first or one way or any of that stuff. Because if it becomes known, I mean, it's your deepest, darkest secret. And if anybody finds out that Gestapo-like knock on the door will be there, and you'll be dragged off, guilty until proven innocent, and literally, it's off with your head. Simply because of what you believe about God. Simply because you believe God is who He says He is. So there are places where your life's in danger. There are other places where you'll get seriously hassled. China comes to mind. Randy Alcorn wrote a great book called Safely Home. And it's about, it's a novel, but it's based on fact, about the Church of Christ in China. Wonderful book if you like to read that kind of, fiction, spiritual fiction or whatever you call it. Alcorn's a great writer and it's a great book. In China, you still have to smuggle Bibles in to get a Bible. It has to be smuggled in. I'd probably be pretty good at that. I have some experience in that. But never mind. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, smuggling the Bibles in. In China now, this is a fairly recent development, but there can be a church, a group of Christians, but you have to register with the government. If you don't register with the government, again, there's that Gestapo-like knock on the door or that raid in the middle of the night that drags you off and puts you in jail waiting for some kind of trial simply because you are one who says, I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God and He died for my sins and I trust Him for my salvation. That's all you got to do. So there are some places you can get killed. Other places where you get thrown in jail or hassled. I suppose just about any place you go, if you're not careful about what you say, you could get, smacked around. If you come on a little too strong in your evangelism or you're a little too persistent, in your trying to force accountability on somebody, I can see the point where a little pop in the nose might be, might be just exactly what you deserve, let alone, likely to happen. All of that's true. But very few of us, very, very few of us will ever truly face real life-threatening danger based solely on believing in God. It's something that most of us will never face. Jesus, on the other hand, as we read here, put himself in harm's way almost every day. His life was in danger. The Romans didn't like talk of other kingdoms or kings besides Rome and Caesar. As a matter of fact, ultimately, that will be why Pilate finally grants the Jews' insistence that they crucify Jesus. We have no king but Caesar, and this guy says he's the king of the Jews. Wait a minute, are you a king? Up to that point, he didn't really care about you. Your religious laws, you guys deal with this yourselves. Keep me out of it, but a king? He says he's a king? Wait a minute. Because if word that there's a king, even a self-proclaimed king, gets back to Caesar in Rome, it'll be my head on the chopping block, says Pilate. So ultimately, that's why he gives in and says, okay, I wash my hands of the whole deal. I find no guilt in this man, but, he didn't say it, but to cover my own bacon, to keep me out of trouble, you guys go ahead. Kill this guy. Israel was not a place that the Roman soldiers enjoyed being assigned to. We have families here in our fellowship who have, soldiers overseas, Iraq, Afghanistan, and I'm sure that's no picnic, to say the least. And probably anybody who's ever served in the military, even, sitting in the O Club on the base in Germany, you're probably complaining all the way because you'd rather be home, right? Well, for a Roman soldier to get your orders and it says you will go to Jerusalem, or Israel and at Caesarea or in Jerusalem at the Praetorium, Praetorian Guard, and you go, oh no, not there. I mean, I thought the earth was square and it dropped off before you got there. It's kind of like going to OMAC or something, it's like, oh, anywhere but out there, And a Roman soldier had the authority to do pretty much whatever he needed to do. Now think about this. If you're a soldier and you get wind of the rumor there's a self-proclaimed king of the Jews, you know, you could be thinking, hey, if I find this guy, and of course I can just pull out my sword and chop his head off. No, that's easy. Nobody asks any questions about that. They might send me home. This might be a sure ticket home. So he faced that danger just walking around, either from the government or from your average soldier, from the Roman government, that very real, life-threatening danger. And even the crowds of the common people, just the folks, they weren't the safest place. We read back in verse 9 where he had to get in that boat offshore so they wouldn't crush him. They were coming after him, like a crowd of teenage girls chasing Elvis, not knowing what they'd do if they caught him, but he was in danger of great harm, if not death, from the people who loved him. We love you so much, we're going to kill you. We're going to rip you limb from limb because I want to take a shoulder home with me. It's better than an autograph. I mean, that was kind of the mindset of the whole deal. So he's in danger from the Roman government. He's in danger from just the common folks, even those ones who loved him. Remember in Nazareth, this is in Luke, Jesus comes back from his desert, testing 40 days in the desert, and he goes back to his hometown, Nazareth, goes into the synagogue, opens a scroll, reads from Isaiah, says, in this, this day in your hearing, this scripture is fulfilled. And they were so blessed, they took him out and tried to throw him off a cliff. His own people. He faced that kind of danger all the time, but, even more dangerous than the Romans, than the government or the soldiers, or the common people, or even, the crowd, the multitude, were the religious leaders. To be Jewish then and now isn't to be a member of a religion. It's not like saying I'm a Baptist or I'm a a Nazarene, or I'm a Calvary Chapel. It's nothing like that. To be a Jew is a race. It's an ethnicity. It's a nationality. It's like being an American. I mean, you're born one. You don't join, and you don't have to do anything really to act like one. You just are, and maybe you act like it, maybe you don't. But these Jewish religious leaders. There was this whole culture, especially in Israel and especially in Jerusalem, that was based around just the nitpicking, toe the line, follow the rules, legalism. And that was really the only spirituality, if I can use that word, that they knew, that they understood. I mean, you want to be religious, you want to go to church, you want to be one with God, however you say that. You want to seek the Lord? Fine. Here's the rule book. You will follow everyone or else. And that was their only experience. That was the only thing they knew. And those with the power to enforce the or else took great joy in that, took great pride in that, because they actually felt they were serving the Lord. Look at the Apostle Paul, or I'll call him Saul. Got papers from headquarters. He had warrants, and he was a bounty hunter to arrest and bring these Christians back for trial and maybe even death, and thought they were doing God a favor. Now, even though Israel was at this time occupied by Rome under military occupation, the Jewish authorities, the religious leaders, had tremendous power and tremendous authority. We would call that clout. They had lots and lots of clout. And no one in their right mind went up against them. And everybody knew that. Pilate learned that. There's a little story. It's not in the Bible. It's in the history books, though. A few years before the events that we're reading about here, when Pilate had first come to Jerusalem as the Roman governor, the procurator, he had a little run-in with the Jews, and we'll skip the details, but he had a run-in with the Jews, and he tried to kind of pull rank and said, I don't care about your silly religion. I represent the Caesar. And the Jews went, oh, really? You're just going to dust us off. You're going to sort of, blow us off. And so the Jews, the leaders, they followed Pilate all the way from Jerusalem to Caesarea. They walked. And they went into the courtyard of the palace at Caesarea, and they kind of restated their case. They said, this is what we want, and this is what we are going to get. And Pilate went, okay, I know how to play this game too. Guards, pull your swords. And so the swords came out on the ready, and the Jews bent over and said, right about here should be the spot. Talk about resolve. And Pilate kind of backed off. If word got back to Rome that his way to solve problems is just to chop everybody's head off, again, it'd be his head on the chopping block. So the Jews had, even though they were under Roman rule, they had a whole lot of clout. And nobody in their right mind would ever go up against them. So how could Jesus be so bold, saying and doing things that he knew could incite and invite the wrath of the Jewish leaders? How could he act so crazy? Easy. He trusted God. He just trusted the Lord. Jesus understood that not a sparrow falls that the Father doesn't know about it. That the hairs on our heads are numbered. The number's getting lower and lower as time goes by, but God knows. You know, every time I use my hairbrush, it's like, oh, bye. Nice knowing you, hair. He wasn't reckless. Jesus wasn't reckless. He wasn't arrogant. He wasn't careless. He didn't tempt fate. He trusted God for his physical safety the same way he trusted God for his security. When God is the center of your life, people might think you're crazy because you belong to his, to the Lord's society. It's one thing to walk away from a good job because it limits what you can do for the Lord. I've actually done that. Quit a pretty good job because they wanted me to work on Sunday, and would rather have gone to church. And so I quit. So it's one thing to quit a job so you can serve the Lord. It's another thing still to put yourself at risk physically in order to serve the Lord, which is what Jesus was doing. But it's another thing altogether to put yourself on public display knowing that you'll be rejected socially. But that's what he did. How many times have you faced a tough decision and heard that voice in the back of your mind say, but what will people think? What will people think? What will the gals think if I don't go to that bachelorette party where they're going to have the stripper? What will our friends think if we miss the big game or the school event because there's something going on at church? What will my fishing buddies think if I blow off Saturday morning in order to go to the men's breakfast? What will my neighbors think if they see our home group all gathered around in the backyard with our Bibles open? And what will they do if they actually hear us singing? They might think we're crazy. What would my wife think if she knew that I was tithing, actually giving 10% of my paycheck to the church, or my husband, whichever way that works? What would the kids think if they saw mom and dad praying together? What would people think? Here's a better question. What would God think? What does God think? See, we're part of his society, not the world's society. Now look at Jesus' society. Who'd he hang out with? Fishermen. Professional fishermen. All night on the boat, walking around up to your knees in dead fish. Stinky fishermen. Tax collectors. You know, treason, traitors, guilty of treason to their religion and their government and their people. Well, you know, like Zacchaeus, the guy up in the tree. Love that story. Tax collectors, political zealots. We read last week as Jesus chose the 12. One of those was a political, you know, a guy whose whole focus was on politics, not spiritual things, not social improvement, but just politics. There, Jesus hung out with lepers and cripples and prostitutes and drunkards, which is the Bible word for alcoholics. He hung out with rejects and losers with one thing in common. One thing they all shared in common. They cared more about what God thought than what people thought. And the people thought that they were all crazy. He's out of his mind. We're going to grab him and drag him out of here, kicking and screaming if we have to. Because they thought he was walking away from the most important things in life. And what he was really doing was trusting God for those things. If Jesus is the Savior, the Bible says he is. If Jesus is the healer that he shows himself to be. If Jesus is the risen Lord that his resurrection proves him to be. Then it's crazy to not follow him. So here's my question. How crazy are you?